He hated Jojen when he got stupid like this. At Winterfell, he wanted me to dream my wolf dreams, and now that I know how, he's always calling me back.
Remember that, Bran. Remember yourself, or the wolf will consume you. When you join, it's not enough to run and hunt and howl in summer skin.
It is for me, Bran thought. He likes summer skin better than his own. What good is it to be a skin changer if you can't wear the skin you like?
Will you remember? And next time, mark the tree. Any tree, it doesn't matter, so long as you do it.
I will. I'll remember. I could go back and do it now if you like. I won't forget this time. But I'll eat my deer first and fight with those little wolves some more.
Jojen shook his head. No, best stay and eat. With your own mouth. A warg cannot live on what his beast consumes.
How would you know? Bran thought resentfully. You've never been a warg. You don't know what it's like.
Hodor jerked suddenly to his feet, almost hitting his head on the barrel-vaulted ceiling.
Hodor!
He shouted, rushing to the door. Mira pushed it open just before he reached it and stepped through into their refuge.
Hodor! Hodor!
The huge stable boy said, grinning. Mira Reed was 16, a woman grown, but she stood no higher than her brother. All the Crannog men were small, she told Bran once, when he asked why she wasn't taller. Brown-haired, green-eyed, and flat as a boy, she walked with a supple grace that Bran could only watch and envy. Mira wore a long, sharp dagger, but her favourite way to fight was with a slender, three-pronged frog spear in one hand and a woven net in the other.
"Who's hungry?"
she asked, holding up her catch, two small silvery trout and six fat green frogs.
"I am," said Bran, "but not for frogs."
Back at Winterfell, before all the bad things had happened, the Walders used to say that eating frogs would turn your teeth green and make moss grow under your arms. He wondered if the Walders were dead. He hadn't seen their corpses at Winterfell, but there had been a lot of corpses, and they hadn't looked inside the buildings.
"We'll just have to feed you, then. Will you help me clean the catch, Bran?"
He nodded. It was hard to sulk with Mira. She was much more cheerful than her brother, and always seemed to know how to make him smile. Nothing ever scared her or made her angry. Well, except Jojen sometimes. Jojen Reed could scare most anyone. He dressed all in green. His eyes were murky as moss, and he had green dreams. What Jojen dreamed came true.
Except he dreamed me dead. And I'm not.
Only he was, in a way. Jojen sent Hodor out for wood and built them a small fire, while Bran and Mira were cleaning the fish and frogs. They used Mira's helm for a cooking pot, chopping up the catch into little cubes and tossing in some water and some wild onions Hodor had found to make a froggy stew. It wasn't as good as deer, but it wasn't bad either, Bran decided as he ate.
"Thank you, Mira," he said. "My lady, you are most welcome, your grace."
"Come the morrow," Jojen announced. "We had best move on."
Bran could see Mira tense.
"Have you had a green dream?"
"No," he admitted.
"Why leave, then?" his sister demanded. "Tumbledown Tower is a good place for us. No villages near, the woods are full of game, there's fish and frogs in the streams and lakes, and who is ever going to find us here? This is not the place we are meant to be. It is safe, though." "It seems safe, I know," said Jojen, "but for how long? There was a battle at Winterfell. We saw the dead. Battles mean wars. If some army should take us unawares..."
"It might be Rob's army," said Bran. "Rob will come back from the south soon. I know he will. He'll come back with all his banners and chase the Iron Men away.
"Your maester said naught of Rob when he lay dying,"
Jojen reminded him.
"Arn men on the stony shore," he said, "and east the bastard of Bolton. Moat Cailin and Deepwood Mott fallen, the heir to Serwin dead, and the castellan of Torren Square. War everywhere," he said, "each man against his neighbour." "We have ploughed this field before," his sister said. "You want to make for the wall and your three-eyed crow. That's well and good, but the wall is a very long way and Bran has no legs but Hodor. If we were eagles, we might fly,"
said Jojen sharply.
"But we have no wings, no more than we have horses." "There are horses to be had," said Mira. "Even in the deep of the Wolfswood, there are foresters, crofters, hunters. Some will have horses." "And if they do, should we steal them? Are we thieves? The last thing we need is men hunting us." "We could buy them," she said. "Trade for them." "Look at us, Mira. A crippled boy with a direwolf, a simple-minded giant, and two Crannog men 1,000 leagues from the neck. We will be known, and word will spread. So long as Bran remains dead, he is safe. Alive, he becomes prey for those who want him dead for good and true."
Jojen went to the fire to prod the embers with a stick.
"Somewhere to the north, the three-eyed crow awaits us. Bran has need of a teacher wiser than me."
"How, Jojen?" his sister asked. "How?"
"A foot," he answered. "A step at a time."
The road from Greywater to Winterfell went on forever, and we were mounted then. You want us to travel a longer road on foot without even knowing where it ends? Beyond the wall, you say? I haven't been there no more than you. But I know that beyond the wall's a big place, Jojen. Are there many three-eyed crows or only one? How do we find him?"
"Perhaps he will find us."
Before Mira could find a reply to that, they heard the sound, the distant howl of a wolf drifting through the night.
"Summer?"
asked Jojen, listening. "No," Bren knew the voice of his direwolf.
"Are you certain?"
said the little grandfather. "Certain. Summer had wandered far afield today and would not be back till dawn."
"Maybe Jojen dreams green, but he can't tell a wolf from a direwolf."
He wondered why they all listened to Jojen so much. He was not a prince like Bran, nor big and strong like Hodor, nor as good a hunter as Mira, yet somehow it was always Jojen telling them what to do.
"We should steal horses, like Mira once," Bran said, "and ride to the Umbers up at Last Hearth." He thought a moment. "Or we could steal a boat and sail down the White Knife to White Harbour Town. That fight Lord Manderley rules there. He was friendly at the harvest feast. He wanted to build ships. Maybe he built some, and we could sail to River Run and bring Rob home with all his army. Then it wouldn't matter who knew I was alive. Rob wouldn't let anyone hurt us."
"Hodor!" burped Hodor. "Hodor! Hodor!"
He was the only one who liked Bran's plan, though. Mira just smiled at him, and Jojen frowned. They never listened to what he wanted, even though Bran was a Stark and a prince besides, and the Reeds of the Neck were Stark bannermen.
"Hodor," said Hodor, swaying. "Hodor, Hodor, 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 Hodor."
Sometimes he liked to do this, just saying his name different ways over and over and over. Other times he would stay so quiet you forgot he was there. There was never any knowing with Hodor.
"Hodor, Hodor, Hodor,"
he shouted. "He's not going to stop," Bran realized.
"Hodor," he said, "why don't you go outside and train with your sword?"
The stable boy had forgotten about his sword, but now he remembered.
Hodor!
He burped. He went for his blade. They had three tomb swords, taken from the crypts of Winterfell, where Bran and his brother Rickon had hidden from Theon Greyjoy's Iron Men. Bran claimed his uncle Brandon's sword, Mira, the one she found upon the knees of his grandfather, Lord Rickard. Hodor's blade was much older, a huge, heavy piece of iron, dull from centuries of neglect and well spotted with rust. He could swing it for hours at a time. There was a rotted tree near the tumblestones that he had hacked half to pieces. Even when he went outside, they could hear him through the walls, bellowing, "Hodor!" as he cut and slashed at his tree. Thankfully, the wolf's wood was huge, and there was not like to be anyone else around to hear.
"Jojen, what did you mean about a teacher?" Bran asked. "You're my teacher. I know I never marked the tree, but I will the next time. My third eye is open like you want it.
So wide open that I fear you may fall through it and live all the rest of your days as a wolf of the woods."
"I won't, I promise. The boy promises. Will the wolf remember?
You run with Summer. You hunt with him, kill with him. But you bend to his will more than him to yours."
"I just forget," Bran complained. "I'm only 9. I'll be better when I'm older. Even Florian the Fool and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight weren't great knights when they were 9.
"That is true," said Jojen, "and a wise thing to say if the days were still growing longer. But they aren't. You are a summer child, I know. Tell me the words of Al Stark."
"Winter is coming."
Just saying it made Bran feel cold. Jojen gave a solemn nod.
"I dreamed of a winged wolf bound to earth by chains of stone and came to Winterfell to free him. The chains are off you now, yet still you do not fly."
"Then you teach me."
Bran still feared the three-eyed crow who haunted his dreams sometimes, pecking endlessly at the skin between his eyes and telling him to fly.
"You're a green seer."
"No," said Jojen, "only a boy who dreams. The green seers were more than that. They were wargs as well as you are, and the greatest of them could wear the skins of any beast that flies or swims or crawls, and could look through the eyes of the weirwoods as well, and see the truth that lies beneath the world. The gods give many gifts, Bran. My sister is a hunter. It is given to her to run swiftly, and stand so still she seems to vanish. She has sharp ears, keen eyes, a steady hand with net and spear. She can breathe mud and fly through trees. I could not do these things, no more than you could. To me the gods gave the green dreams, and to you, you could be more than me, Bran. You are the winged wolf, and there is no saying how far and high you might fly if you had someone to teach you. How can I help you master a gift I do not understand? We remember the first men in the Neck, and the children of the forest who were their friends, but so much is forgotten, and so much we never knew."
Mira took Bran by the hand.
"If we stay here, troubling no one, you'll be safe until the war ends. You will not learn, though, except what my brother can teach you, and you've heard what he says. If we leave this place to seek refuge at Last Hearth or beyond the wall, we risk being taken. You're only a boy, I know, but you are our prince as well, our lord's son, and our king's true heir. We have sworn you our faith by earth and water, bronze and iron, ice and fire. The risk is yours, Bran, as is the gift. The choice should be yours too, I think. We are your servants to command."
She grinned.
"At least in this."
"You mean..."
Bran said. You'll do what I say? Truly? Truly, my prince, the girl replied. So consider well.
Bran tried to think it through, the way his father might have. The great John's uncles, Hotha Horsebane and Moore's Crowfood, were fierce men. But he thought they would be loyal, and the Karstarks them too. Carhold was a strong castle, father always said.
We would be safe with the Umbers or the Karstarks.
Or they could go south to fat Lord Manderly. At Winterfell he'd laughed a lot, and never seemed to look at Bran with so much pity as the other lords. Castle Serwyn was closer than White Harbour, but Maester Luan had said that Clay Serwyn was dead. The Umbers and the Carstocks and the Manderleys may all be dead as well, he realized, as he would be if he was caught by the Ironmen or the Bastard of Bolton. If they stayed here, hidden down beneath Tumbledown Tower, no one would find them. He would stay alive. And crippled. Bran realized he was crying.
Stupid baby, he thought to himself.
No matter where he went, to Carhold, or White Harbour, or Greywater Watch, he'd be a cripple when he got there. He balled his hands into fists.
I want to fly, he told them. Please, take me to the Crow.
Brain. The gates of Duskendale were closed and barred. Through the pre-dawn gloom, the town walls shimmered palely. On their ramparts, wisps of fog moved like ghostly sentinels. A dozen wains and ox carts had drawn up outside the gates, waiting for the sun to rise. Brain took her place behind some turnips. Her calves ached, and it felt good to dismount and stretch her legs. Before long, another wain came rumbling from the woods. By the time the sky began to lighten, the queue stretched back a quarter mile. The farm folk gave her curious glances, but no one spoke to her. It is for me to talk to them, Brian told herself, but she had always found it hard to speak with strangers. Even as a girl, she had been shy. Long years of scorn had only made her shyer. I must ask after Sansa. How else will I find her? She cleared her throat. Good wife, she said to the woman on the turnip cart. Perhaps you saw my sister on the road. A young maid, 3 and 10 and fair of face, with blue eyes and auburn hair. She may be riding with a drunken knight. The woman shook her head, but her husband said, Then she's no maid, I'll wager. Does the poor girl have a name? Brain's head was empty. I should have made up some name for her. Any name would do, but none came to her. No name? Well, the roads are full of nameless girls. The lich yard's even fuller, said his wife. As dawn broke, guardsmen appeared on the parapets. The farmers climbed onto their wagons and shook the reins. Brain mounted as well and took a glance behind her. Most of the queue, waiting to enter Duskendale, were farm folk with loads of fruits and vegetables to sell. A pair of wealthy townsmen sat on well-bred palfreys a dozen places behind her, and farther back she spied a skinny boy on a piebald roundsey. There was no sign of the two knights, nor Sir Shadrick the Mad Mouse. The guards were waving through the wains with scarce a look, but when Brian reached the gate, she gave them pause. "Halt you!" the captain cried. A pair of men in chainmail hauberks crossed their spears to bar her way. "State your purpose here." "I seek the Lord of Duskendale, or his maester." The captain's eyes lingered on her shield. "The Black Bat of Lothston. Those are arms of ill repute." "They are not mine. I mean to have the shield repainted." "Aye." The captain rubbed his stubbled chin. "My sister does such work as it happens. You'll find her at the house with the painted doors across from the Seven Swords." He gestured to the guards. "Let her pass, lads. It's a wench." The gatehouse opened on a market square, where those who had entered before her were unloading to hawk their turnips, yellow onions, and sacks of barleycorn. Others were selling arms and armor, and very cheaply, to judge from the prices they shouted out as she rode by. The looters come with the carrion crows after every battle. Brain walked her horse past mail shirts, still caked with brown blood, dinted helms, notched longswords. There was clothing to be had as well, leather boots, fur cloaks, stained surcoats with suspicious rents. She knew many of the badges, the mailed fist, the moose, the white sun, the double-bladed axe, all those were northern sigils. Tali men had perished here as well, though, and many from the Stormlands. She saw red and green apples, a shield that bore the three thunderbolts of Laygood, horse trappings patterned with the ants of Ambrose. Lord Tarly's own striding huntsman appeared on many a badge and brooch and doublet. Friend or foe, the crows care not. There were pine and linden shields to be had for pennies, but Brian rode past them. She meant to keep the heavy oaken shield Jamie had given her, the one he'd borne himself from Harrenhal to King's Landing. A pine shield had its advantages. It was lighter, and therefore easier to bear, and the soft wood was more like to trap a foeman's axe or sword. But oak gave more protection if you were strong enough to bear its weight. Duskendale was built around its harbour. North of town, the chalk cliffs rose. To the south, a rocky headland shielded the ships at anchor from storms coming up the narrow sea. The castle overlooked the port, its square keep and big drum towers visible from every part of town. In the crowded cobbled streets, it was easier to walk than ride, so Brian put her mare up in a stable and continued on afoot, with her shield slung across her back and her bedroll tucked up beneath one arm. The captain's sister was not hard to find. The Seven Swords was the largest inn in town, a four-story structure that towered over its neighbours, and the double doors on the house across the way were painted gorgeously. They showed a castle in an autumn wood, the trees done up in shades of gold and russet. Ivy crawled up the trunks of ancient oaks, and even the acorns had been done with loving care. When Brian peered more closely, she saw creatures in the foliage, a sly red fox, two sparrows on a branch, and behind those leaves the shadow of a boar. "Your door is very pretty," she told the dark-haired woman who answered when she knocked. "What castle is that meant to be?"
"All castles," said the captain's sister. "The only one I know is the Dunfort by the harbour. I made t'other in my head what a castle ought to look like. I never seen a dragon neither, nor a griffin, nor a unicorn."
She had a cheerful manner, but when Brian showed her the shield, her face went dark.
"My old ma used to say that giant bats flew out from Harrenhal on moonless nights to carry bad children to Mad Dennell for her cookpots. Sometimes I'd hear them scrabbling at the shutters."
She sucked her teeth a moment, thoughtful.
"What goes in its place?"
The arms of Tarth were quartered rose and azure and bore a yellow sun and crescent moon. But so long as men believed her to be a murderess, Brian dare not carry them.
"Your door reminded me of an old shield I once saw in my father's armory."
She described the arms as best she could recall them. The woman nodded.
"I can paint it straight away, but the paint will need to dry. Take a room at the Seven Swords, if it please you. I'll bring the shield to you by morning."
Brian had not meant to overnight in Duskendale, but it might be for the best. She did not know if the lord of the castle was in residence or whether he would consent to see her. She thanked the painter and crossed the cobblestones to the inn. Above its door, seven wooden swords swung beneath an iron spike. The whitewash that covered them was cracked and peeling, but Brian knew their meaning. They stood for the seven sons of Darklin who had worn the white cloaks of the Kingsguard. No other house in all the realm could claim as many. They were the glory of their house, and now they are a sign above an inn. She pushed into the common room and asked the innkeep for a room and a bath. He put her on the second floor, and a woman with a liver-coloured birthmark on her face brought up a wooden tub, and then the water, pail by pail.
"Do any Darklins remain in Duskendale?"
Brain asked as she climbed into the tub. "Well, there's darks, and one myself. My husband says I was dark before we wed and darker afterward," she laughed. "Can't throw a stone in Duskendere without you hit some dark or darkwood or dargood. But the lordly darklings are all gone. Lord Denny's was the last of them, the sweet young fool. Did you know the darklings were kings in Duskendale before the Andals come? You'd never know to look at me, but I got me royal blood. Can you see it? Your Grace, another cup of ale? I ought to make them say, 'Your Grace, the chamber pot needs emptying and fetching some fresh faggots. Your bloody Grace, the fire's going out.'" She laughed again and shook the last drops from the pail. "Well, there you are. Is that water hot enough for you?" "It will serve." The water was lukewarm. "I'd bring up more, but it'd just slop over. A girl the size of you, you fill a tub." Only a cramped, small tub like this one. At Harrenhal, the tubs had been huge and made of stone. The bathhouse had been thick with the steam rising off the water, and Jamie had come walking through that mist, naked as his name day, looking half a corpse and half a god. "He climbed into the tub with me," she remembered, blushing. She seized a chunk of hard lye soap and scrubbed under her arms, trying to call up Renly's face again. By the time the water had gone cold, Brain was as clean as she was like to get. She put on the same clothes she had taken off and girded her sword belt tight around her hips, but her mail and helm she left behind so as not to seem so threatening at the Dun Fort. It felt good to stretch her legs. The guards at the castle gates wore leather jacks with a badge that showed crossed warhammers upon a white saltire. "I would speak with your lord," Brain told them. One laughed. "Best shout out loud, then." "Lord Riker rode to Maidenpool with Randall Tarley," the other said. "He left Sir Rufus Leake as castellan to look after Lady Riker and the young ones." It was to Leake that they escorted her. Sir Rufus was a short, stout greybeard whose left leg ended in a stump. "You will forgive me if I do not rise," he said. Brain offered him her letter, but Leake could not read, so he sent it to the maester, a bald man with a freckled scalp and a stiff red moustache. When he heard the name Hollard, the maester frowned with irritation. "How often must I sing this song?" Her face must have given her away. "Did you think you were the first to come seeking after Dantos? More like the 21st. The gold cloaks were here within days of the king's murder with Lord Tywin's warrant. And what do you have, pray?" Brain showed him the letter with Tommen's seal and childish signature. The maester hummed and heard, picked at the wax, and finally gave it back. "It seems in order." He climbed onto a stool and gestured Brain to another. "I never knew Sir Dantos. He was a boy when he left Duskendale. The Hollards were a noble house once, 'tis true. You know their arms? Barry red and pink, with three golden crowns upon a blue chief. The Darklins were petty kings during the Age of Heroes, and three took Hollard wives. Later, their little realm was swallowed up by larger kingdoms, yet the Darklins endured and the Hollards served them, aye, even in defiance. You know of that?" "A little." Her own maester used to say that it was the defiance of Duskendale that had driven King Aerys mad. "In Duskendale they love Lord Denny still, despite the woe he brought them. 'Tis Lady Serala that they blame, his mirish wife. The Lace Serpent, she is called. If Lord Darklyn had only wed a Staunton or a Stokeworth, well, you know how small folk will go on. The Lace Serpent filled her husband's ear with mirish poison, they say, until Lord Denny's rose against his king and took him captive. In the taking, his master-at-arms, Sir Simon Hollard, cut down Sir Gawain Gaunt of the Kingsguard. For half a year Aerys was held within these very walls, whilst the king's hand sat outside Duskendale with a mighty host. Lord Tywin had sufficient strength to storm the town any time he wished, but Lord Denny sent word that at the first sign of assault he'd kill the king." Brain remembered what came next. "The king was rescued," she said. Barristan the Bold brought him out. He did, the maester said. Once Lord Denny's lost his hostage, he opened his gates and ended his defiance, rather than let Lord Tywin take the town. He bent the knee and begged for mercy, but the king was not of a forgiving mind. Lord Denny's lost his head, as did his brothers and his sister, uncles, cousins, all the lordly Darklins. The lace serpent was burned alive, poor woman, though her tongue was torn out first, and her female parts, with which it was said that she had enslaved her lord. Half of Duskendale will still tell you that Aerys was too kind to her. And the Hollards? Tainted and destroyed, said the maester. I was forging my chain at the citadel when this happened, but I have read the accounts of their trials and punishments. Sir John Hollard, the steward, was wed to Lord Denny's sister and died with his wife, as did their young son, who was half Darklin. Robin Hollard was a squire, and when the king was seized, he danced around him and pulled his beard. He died upon the rack. Sir Simon Hollard was slain by Sir Barristan during the king's escape. The Hollard lands were taken, their castle torn down, their villages put to the torch. As with the Darklins, House Hollard was extinguished. Save for Dontos. True enough, young Dontos was the son of Sir Stephen Hollard, the twin brother of Sir Simon, who had died of a fever some years before and had no part in the defiance. Aerys would have taken the boy's head off nonetheless, but Sir Barristan asked that his life be spared. The king could not refuse the man who'd saved him, so Dontos was taken to King's Landing as a squire. To my knowledge, he never returned to Duskendale, and why should he? He held no lands here, had neither kin nor castle. If Dontos and his northern girl helped murder our sweet king, it seems to me that they would want to put as many leagues as they could betwixt themselves and justice. Look for them in Old Town, if you must, or across the narrow sea. Look for them in Dawn or on the Wall. Look elsewhere. He rose. I hear my ravens calling. You will forgive me if I bid you good morrow. The walk back to the inn seemed longer than the walk to the Dun Fort, though perhaps that was only her mood. She would not find Sansa Stark in Duskendale, that seemed plain. If Sir Dontos had taken her to Old Town or across the narrow sea, as the maester seemed to think, Brienne's quest was hopeless. What was there for her in Old Town? She asked herself. The maester never knew her, no more than he knew Hollard. She would not have gone to strangers. In King's Landing, Brienne had found one of Sansa's former maids doing washing in a brothel. "I served with Lord Renly before my lady Sansa, and both turned traitor," the woman Brella complained bitterly. "No lord will touch me now, so I have to wash for whores." But when Brienne asked about Sansa, she said, "I'll tell what I told Lord Tywin. That girl was always praying. She'd go to sept and light her candles like a proper lady, but near every night she went off to the Godswood. She's gone back north, she has. That's where her gods are." The north was huge, though, and Brienne had no notion which of her father's bannermen Sansa might have been most inclined to trust. Or would she seek her own blood instead? Though all of her siblings had been slain, Brienne knew that Sansa still had an uncle and a bastard half-brother on the wall, serving in the Night's Watch. Another uncle, Edmure Tully, was a captive at the Twins, but his uncle, Sir Brynden, still held River Run, and Lady Catelyn's younger sister ruled the Vale. Blood calls to blood. Sansa might well have run to one of them. Which one, though? The war was too far, surely, and a bleak and bitter place besides. And to reach Riverrun, the girl would need to cross the war-torn riverlands and pass through the Lannister siege lines. The Eyrie would be simpler, and Lady Lysa would surely welcome her sister's daughter. Ahead, the alley bent. Somehow, Brienne had taken a wrong turn. She found herself in a dead end, a small muddy yard, where three pigs were rooting round a low stone well. One squealed at the sight of her, and an old woman drawing water looked her up and down suspiciously. "What would you be wanting?" "I was looking for the Seven Swords.
back the way you come, left at the sept. I thank you.
Brain turned to retrace her steps and walked headfirst into someone hurrying round the bend. The collision knocked him off his feet, and he landed on his arse in the mud.
Pardons, she murmured.
He was only a boy, a scrawny lad with straight thin hair and a sty beneath one eye.
Are you hurt?
She offered a hand to help him up, but the boy squirmed back away from her on heels and elbows. He could not have been more than 10 or 12, though he wore a chainmail burnie and had a long sword in a leather sheath slung across his back.
Do I know you?
Brain asked. His face seemed vaguely familiar, though she could not think from where.
No, you don't. You never...
He scrambled to his feet.
Forgive me, my lady. I wasn't looking... I mean, I was, but down. I was looking down at my feet.
The boy took to his heels, plunging headlong back the way he'd come. Something about him roused all of Brain's suspicions, but she was not about to chase him through the streets of Duskendale.
Outside the gates this morning. That was where I saw him, she realized. He was riding a piebald roundsey.
And it seemed as if she had seen him somewhere else as well, but where? By the time Brain found the seven swords again, the common room was crowded. Four scepters sat closest to the fire in robes stained and dusty from the road. Elsewhere, locals filled the benches, sopping up bowls of hot crab stew with chunks of bread. The smell made her stomach rumble, but she saw no empty seats. Then a voice behind her said,
"Milady, here, have my place."
Not until he hopped off the bench did Brain realize that the speaker was a dwarf. The little man was not quite 5 feet tall. His nose was veined and bulbous, his teeth red from sour leaf, and he was dressed in the brown rough-spun robes of a holy brother, with the iron hammer of the smith dangling down about his thick neck.
"Keep your seat," she said. "I can stand as well as you."
"Aye, but my head is not so apt to knock upon the ceiling."
The dwarf's speech was coarse but courteous. Brain could see the crown of his scalp where he had shaved it. Many holy brothers wore such tonsures. Scepter Roel once told her that it was meant to show that they had nothing to hide from the father.
"Can't the father see through hair?" Brain had asked, a stupid thing to say.
She had been a slow child. Scepter Roel often told her so. She felt near as stupid now, so she took the little man's place at the end of the bench, signalled for stew, and turned to thank the dwarf.
"Do you serve some holy house in Duskendale, brother?"
"'Twas near Maidenpool, my lady, but the wolves burned us out,"
the man replied, gnawing on a heel of bread.
"We rebuilt as best we could, until some sellswords come. I could not say whose men they were, but they took our pigs and killed the brothers. I squeezed inside a hollow log and hid, but t'others were too big. It took me a long time to bury them all, but the smith, he gave me strength. When that was done, I dug up a few coins the elder brother had hid by, and set off by myself.
I met some other brothers going to King's Landing.
Aye, there's hundreds on the roads. Not only brothers, septons too, and small folk. Sparrows all. Might be I'm a sparrow too. The smith, he made me small enough,"
he chuckled. "And what's your sad tale, my lady?"
"I am looking for my sister. She's highborn, only 3 and 10, a pretty maid with blue eyes and auburn hair. You may have seen her travelling with a man, a knight, perhaps a fool. There's gold for the man who helps me find her."
"Gold?"
The brother gave her a red smile. "A bowl of that crab stew would be enough reward for me, but I fear I cannot help you.
Fools I've met, and plenty, but not so many pretty maids."
He cocked his head and thought a moment. "There was a fool at Maidenpool, now that I think of it. He was clad in rags and dirt, as near as I could tell, but under the dirt was motley."
Did Dantos Hollard wear motley?
No one had told Brain that he did, but no one had ever said he didn't, either. Why would the man be in rags, though? Had some misfortune overtaken him and Sansa, after they fled King's Landing? That could well be, with the road so dangerous.
It might not have been him at all.
Did this fool have a red nose full of broken veins?
I could not swear to that. I confess I paid him little heed. I'd gone to Maidenpool after burying my brothers, thinking that I might find a ship to take me to King's Landing. I first glimpsed the fool down by the docks. He had a furtive air to him and took care to avoid Lord Tarley's soldiers. Later I encountered him again at the Stinking Goose.
The Stinking Goose?
She said, uncertain. An unsavoury place, the dwarf admitted. Lord Tarley's men patrol the port at Maidenpool, but the Goose is always full of sailors, and sailors have been known to smuggle men aboard their ships if the price is right. This fool was seeking passage for three across the narrow sea. I oft saw him there talking with oarsmen off the galleys. Sometimes he would sing a funny song.
Seeking passage for three, not two.
Three, m'lady. That I'd swear to, by the seven.
Three,
she thought. Sansa, Sir Dontos. But who would be the third?
The imp?
Did the fool find his ship?
That I could not say, the dwarf told her. But one night some of Lord Tarly's soldiers visited the Goose looking for him, and a few days later I heard another man boasting that he'd fooled a fool, and had the gold to prove it. He was drunk and buying ale for everyone.
Fooled a fool? She said. What did he mean by that?
I could not tell you. His name was Nimble Dick, though, that I do recall.
The dwarf spread his hands. I fear that's all that I can offer you, aside from a small man's prayers.
True to her word, Brain bought him his bowl of hot crab stew, and some hot fresh bread and a cup of wine as well. As he ate it, standing by her side, she mulled what he had told her.
Could the imp have joined them?
If Tyrion Lannister were behind Sansa's disappearance and not Dontos Hollard, it stood to reason that they would need to flee across the narrow sea. When the little man was done with his bowl of stew, he finished what was left of hers as well.
"You should eat more," he said. "A woman big as you needs to keep her strength up. It is not far to Maidenpool, but the road is perilous these days."
"I know." It was on that very road that Sir Cleos Frey had died, and she and Sir Jaime had been taken by the Bloody Mummers.
Jaime tried to kill me, she remembered, though he was gaunt and weak and his wrists were chained.
It had been a close thing, even so, but that was before Zolo hacked his hand off. Zolo and Rorge and Shagwell would have raped her 50 times if Sir Jaime had not told them she was worth her weight in sapphires.
"M'lady, you look sad. Are you thinking of your sister?"
The dwarf patted her on the hand.
"The crone will light your way to her, never fear. The maiden will keep her safe."
"I pray that you are right."
"I am,"
he bowed. "But now I must be on my way. I have a long way yet to go to reach King's Landing.
Do you have a horse? A mule?"
2 mules!" The little man laughed. "There they are at the bottom of my legs. They get me where I want to go." He bowed and waddled to the door, swaying with each step. She remained at the table after he had gone, lingering over a cup of watered wine. Brain did not often drink wine, but once in a great while she found it helped to settle her belly.
"And where do I want to go?"
she asked herself. "To Maidenpool? To look for a man named Nimble Dick in a place called the Stinking Goose?" When last she had seen Maidenpool, the town had been a desolation, its lord shut up inside his castle, its small folk dead or fled or hiding. She remembered burned houses and empty streets, smashed and broken gates. Feral dogs had skulked along behind their horses, whilst swollen corpses floated like huge pale water lilies atop the spring-fed pool that gave the town its name.
"Jaime sang 6 maids in a pool, and laughed when I begged him to be quiet."
And Randall Tarley was at Maidenpool as well, another reason for her to avoid the town. She might do better to take ship for Gulltown or White Harbour. "I could do both, though. Pay a call on the Stinking Goose and talk to this Nimble Dick, then find a ship at Maidenpool to take me further north." The common room had begun to empty. Brain tore a chunk of bread in half, listening to the talk at the other tables. Most of it concerned the death of Lord Tywin Lannister.
"Murdered by his own son, they say,"
a local man was saying. "A cobbler, by the look of him. That vile little dwarf."
And the king is just a boy, said the oldest of the four scepters. Who is to rule us till he comes of age?
Lord Tywin's brother, said a guardsman, or that Lord Tyrell might be, or the Kingslayer.
Not him, declared the innkeep, not that oathbreaker.
He spat into the fire. Brain let the bread fall from her hands and wiped the crumbs off on her breeches. She'd heard enough. That night she dreamed herself in Renly's tent again. All the candles were guttering out and the cold was thick around her. Something was moving through green darkness. Something foul and horrible was hurtling toward her king. She wanted to protect him, but her limbs felt stiff and frozen, and it took more strength than she had just to lift her hand. And when the shadow sword sliced through the green steel gorget and the blood began to flow, she saw that the dying king was not Renly after all, but Jaime Lannister, and she had failed him. The captain's sister found her in the common room, drinking a cup of milk and honey with three raw eggs mixed in. "You did beautifully," she said when the woman showed her the freshly painted shield. It was more a picture than a proper coat of arms, and the sight of it took her back through the long years to the cool dark of her father's armory. She remembered how she'd run her fingertips across the cracked and fading paint, over the green leaves of the tree and along the path of the falling star. Brain paid the captain's sister half again the sum they had agreed and slung the shield across one shoulder when she left the inn, after buying some hard bread, cheese, and flour from the cook. She left the town by the north gate, riding slowly through the fields and farms where the worst of the fighting had been when the wolves came down on Duskendale. Lord Randall Tarly had commanded Joffrey's army, made up of Westermen and Stormlanders and knights from the Reach. Those men of his who had died here had been carried back inside the walls to rest in heroes' tombs beneath the septs of Duskendale. The northern dead, far more numerous, were buried in a common grave beside the sea. Above the cairn that marked their resting place, the victors had raised a rough-hewn wooden marker. "Here lie the wolves," was all it said. Brain stopped beside it and said a silent prayer for them, and for Catelyn Stark and her son Rob, and all the men who died with them as well. She remembered the night that Lady Catelyn had learned her sons were dead, the two young boys she'd left at Winterfell to keep them safe. Brain had known that something was terribly amiss. She had asked her if there had been news of her sons. "I have no sons but Rob," Lady Catelyn had replied. She had sounded as if a knife were twisting her belly. Brain had reached across the table to give her comfort, but she stopped before her fingers brushed the older woman's, for fear that she would flinch away. Lady Catelyn had turned over her hands to show Brain the scars on her palms and fingers, where a knife once bit deep into her flesh. Then she had begun to talk about her daughters. "Sansa was a little lady," she had said, "always courteous and eager to please. She loved tales of knightly valor. She will grow into a woman far more beautiful than I. You can see that. I would often brush her hair myself. She had auburn hair, thick and soft. The red in it would shine like copper in the light of the torches." She had spoken of Arya, too, her younger daughter, but Arya was lost, most likely dead by now. "Sansa, though, I will find her, my lady," Brain swore to Lady Catelyn's restless shade. "I will never stop looking. I will give up my life if need be, give up my honor, give up all my dreams, but I will find her." Beyond the battleground, the road ran beside the shore between the surging grey-green sea and a line of low limestone hills. Brain was not the only traveller on the road. There were fishing villages up along the coast for many leagues, and the fisherfolk used this road to take their fish to market. She rode past a fishwife and her daughters, walking home with empty baskets on their shoulders. In her armour, they took her for a knight until they saw her face. Then the girls whispered to one another and gave her looks. "Have you seen a maid of 3 and 10 along the road?" she asked them, "a high-born maid with blue eyes and auburn hair." Sir Shadrick had made her wary, but she had to keep on trying.
She may have been travelling with a fool. But they only shook their heads and giggled at her behind their hands. In the first village she came to, barefoot boys ran along beside her horse. She had donned her helm, stung by the giggles of the fisherfolk, so they took her for a man. One boy offered to sell her clams, one offered crabs, and one offered her his sister. Brain bought three crabs from the second boy. By the time she left the village, it had begun to rain, and the wind was rising. Storm coming, she thought, glancing out to sea. The raindrops pinged against the steel of her helm, making her ears ring as she rowed. But it was better than being out there in a boat. An hour farther north, the road divided at a pile of tumbled stones that marked the ruins of a small castle. The right-hand fork followed the coast, meandering up along the shore toward Crackclaw Point, a dismal land of bogs and pine barrens. The left hand ran through hills and fields and woods to Maidenpool. The rain was falling more heavily by then. Brian dismounted and led her mare off the road to take shelter amongst the ruins. The course of the castle walls could still be discerned amongst the brambles, weeds, and wild elms, but the stones that had made them up were strewn like a child's blocks between the roads. Part of the main keep still stood, however. Its triple towers were grey granite, like the broken walls, but their merlons were yellow sandstone. 3 crowns, she realized as she gazed at them through the rain. 3 golden crowns. This had been a Hollard castle. Sir Dontos had been born here, like as not. She led her mare through the rubble to the keep's main entrance. Of the door only rusted iron hinges remained, but the roof was still sound and it was dry within. Brain tied her mare to a wall sconce, took off her helm and shook out her hair. She was searching for some dry wood to light a fire when she heard the sound of another horse coming closer. Some instinct made her step back into the shadows where she could not be seen from the road. This was the very road where she and Sir Jamie had been captured. She did not intend to suffer that again. The rider was a small man. The Mad Mouse, she thought at her first sight of him. Somehow he's followed me. Her hand went to her sword hilt, and she found herself wondering if Sir Shadrick would think her easy prey just because she was a woman. Lord Grandison's castellan had once made that error. Humphrey Wagstaff was his name, a proud old man of 65, with a nose like a hawk and a spotted head. The day they were betrothed, he warned Brian that he would expect her to be a proper woman once they'd wed. "I will not have my lady wife cavorting about in man's mail. On this you shall obey me, lest I be forced to chastise you." She was 16 and no stranger to a sword, but still shy despite her prowess in the yard. Yet somehow she had found the courage to tell Sir Humphrey that she would accept chastisement only from a man who could outfight her. The old knight purpled, but agreed to don his own armour to teach her a woman's proper place. They fought with blunted, tawny weapons, so Brain's mace had no spikes. She broke Sir Humphrey's collarbone, 2 ribs, and their betrothal. He was her 3rd prospective husband and her last. Her father did not insist again. If it was Sir Shadrick dogging her heels, she might well have a fight on her hands. She did not intend to partner with the man or let him follow her to Sansa. He had the sort of easy arrogance that comes with skill at arms, she thought. But he was small. I'll have the reach on him, and I should be stronger, too. Brian was as strong as most knights, and her old master-at-arms used to say that she was quicker than any woman her size had any right to be. The gods had given her stamina, too, which Sir Goodwin deemed a noble gift. Fighting with sword and shield was a wearisome business, and victory oft went to the man with the most endurance. Sir Goodwin had taught her to fight cautiously, to conserve her strength while letting her foes spend theirs in furious attacks. "Men will always underestimate you," he said, "and their pride will make them want to vanquish you quickly, lest it be said that a woman tried them sorely." She had learned the truth of that once she went into the world. Even Jaime Lannister had come at her that way in the woods by Maidenpool.
If the gods were good, the Mad Mouse would make the same mistake. He may be a seasoned knight, she thought, but he is no Jaime Lannister. She slid her sword out of its scabbard. But it was not Sir Shadrick's chestnut courser that drew up where the road forked, but a broken-down old piebald roundsey with a skinny boy upon his back. When Brian saw the horse, she drew back in confusion. Only some boy, she thought, until she glimpsed the face beneath his hood. The boy in Duskendale. The one who bumped into me. It's him. The boy never gave the ruined castle a glance, but looked down one road, then the other. After a moment's hesitation, he turned the roundsey toward the hills and plodded on. Brain watched him vanish through the falling rain, and suddenly it came to her that she had seen this same boy in Rosby. He is stalking me, she realized, but that's a game that two can play. She untied her mare, climbed back into the saddle, and went after him. The boy was staring at the ground as he rode, watching the ruts in the road fill up with water. The rain muffled the sound of her approach, and no doubt his hood played a part as well. He never looked back once until Brain trotted up behind him and gave the roundsey a whack across the rump with the flat of her longsword. The horse reared, and the skinny boy went flying, his cloak flapping like a pair of wings. He landed in the mud and came up with dirt and dead brown grass between his teeth to find Brain standing over him. It was the same boy beyond a doubt. She recognized the sty. "Who are you?" she demanded. The boy's mouth worked soundlessly. His eyes were big as eggs. "Puh!" was all he could manage. "Puh!" His chainmail burnie made a rattling sound when he shivered. "Puh! Puh!" "Please," said Brain. "Are you saying please?" She laid the point of her sword on the apple of his throat. "Please tell me who you are and why you're following me."
"Not please."
He stuck a finger in his mouth and flicked away a clump of mud, spitting.
"Pod, my name. Podrick. Pain."
Brain lowered her sword. She felt a rush of sympathy for the boy. She remembered a day at evenfall and a young knight with a rose in his hand. "He brought the rose to give to me," or so her scepter told her. All she had to do was welcome him to her father's castle. He was 18 with long red hair that tumbled to his shoulders. She was 12, tightly laced into a stiff new gown, its bodice bright with garnets. The two of them were of a height, but she could not look him in the eye, nor say the simple words her scepter had taught her. "Sir Ronnet, I welcome you to my lord father's hall. It is good to look upon your face at last." "Why are you following me?" she demanded of the boy. "Were you told to spy upon me? Do you belong to Varys or the queen?"
"No, not neither. No one."
Brain put his age at 10, but she was terrible at judging how old a child was. She always thought they were younger than they were, perhaps because she had always been big for her age. "Freakish big," Scepter Roel used to say, "and mannish. This road is too dangerous for a boy alone."
"Not for a squire. I'm his squire, the hand squire."
"Lord Tywin?" Brain sheathed her blade.
"No, not that hand. The one before, his son. I fought with him in the battle. I shouted, 'Half man, half man!'"
The imp's squire. Brain had not even known he had one. Tyrion Lannister was no knight. He might have been expected to have a serving boy or two to attend him, she supposed, a page and a cupbearer, someone to help dress him. But a squire. "Why are you stalking after me?" she said. "What do you want?"
"To find her?" The boy got to his feet. "His lady. You're looking for her? Brella told me. She's his wife. Not Brella. Lady Sansa. So I thought, if you found her..."
His face twisted in sudden anguish.
"I'm his squire," he repeated, as the rain ran down his face. "But he left me."
Davos. Lightning split the northern sky, etching the black tar of the night lamp against the blue-white sky. 6 heartbeats later came the thunder, like a distant drum.